This program is intended for a printed paired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. I'm Naomi, and today I will be reading from A Place for Us by Nicholas Gage. We are resuming Chapter 16. I blinked in the bright sunlight and saw the imposing figure of John Kennedy standing in front of his desk, holding out his hands in greeting. Then I heard a commotion and turned around to discover several dozen reporters with cameras and microphones pointed toward us. They were all shouting, flashing light bulbs, waving, and calling to me as if I were Cary Grant disembarking from the Queen Elizabeth II. "Look this way, Mr. Gage. Smile, please. How do you feel meeting the president?" After posing until the photographers were satisfied, Kennedy shooed most of them out of the room and spoke to each of us individually. He was relaxed and seemed to be enjoying himself, perhaps because his first job after leaving the Navy had been as a reporter for the Hearst Corporation, and he enjoyed the company of journalists and Randolph Hearst. He obviously had been briefed on our backgrounds and made much of the fact that he and I were both from Massachusetts. "You're getting a great start with this award," he said to me. "You're obviously a much better reporter than I was. I was pretty bad, wasn't I, Randolph?" Hearst told him briefly how I had come to America as a war refugee and managed to learn English, entered journalism school, and work my way through college with a combination of academic scholarships and part-time jobs. "And you're doing all this so you can become a reporter?" Kennedy asked. "Why do you want to be a newspaper man?" "Just a masochist, I guess," I answered, because I couldn't think of any way to encapsulate all of my reasons in a few words. Everyone laughed as if this were a pearl of wit, and it was widely quoted in the newspapers the next day. The quarter hour we spent in the Oval Office passed in an instant. Back in the hotel, I immediately called my family to tell them about the president. They listened politely, but all they asked was whether he had offered me anything to eat. I was disappointed at their reaction, but the next day, when my picture, standing next to Kennedy, appeared on the front page of the Worcester Telegram, they called me, frantic with excitement. They didn't really believe I had met Kennedy until they saw it in the paper. No one I know, no Greek in Worcester or Massachusetts or all of Greece, for that matter, can say what I can say, my father proclaimed over the phone. I am an uneducated immigrant, and my son has been entertained by the President of the United States in the White House. I hoped for great things for you, but I never imagined glory like this. My sisters told me later that Father went out and bought himself a suit in order to be properly dressed for his new status when he received the congratulations of the Worcester Greeks. From the haberdashery, he went to the coffee house and spent the rest of the day buying drinks for the patrons. All those men who had bought full-page ads in St. Spiridon's commemorative album and whose names were immortalized in the church's stained glass windows and who had dined with the archbishop when he came to town, but who did not have sons who went to the White House. That day, my father bought many copies of the Worcester paper and cut out the picture of me with Kennedy. He had one of those laminated in plastic, and then carried the plastic-coated newspaper photo in his breast pocket, producing it at the slightest excuse to show friends, relatives, and total strangers. Each time he told of his son's honor, he ended with the words, "God bless America." I found the much-worn, nearly unrecognizable photo still in his breast pocket on the day he died. No one had told me that the award festivities would continue for 2 more days in New York City. I put on my slightly wrinkled suit once again, and we traveled as a group by train from Washington, D.C., my first train ride. As we sat in the club car, some of the Hearst executives and Randolph Hearst himself quizzed me about my future plans. I told them that I hoped to go to Columbia if I could only manage to save up the extra $1,000 I needed by next fall. When we reached New York, we were settled in a Midtown hotel and told to be ready at noon the next day to attend a luncheon in our honor at Toots Shores Restaurant. I had never seen Manhattan except for New York Harbor on the day we arrived in 1949. The city seemed like a huge movie set, its canyons choked with people and traffic at the foot of the improbably high skyscrapers. On the morning before the luncheon, I decided to call Columbia Journalism School. When I reached the assistant dean, Richard Baker, he asked me to come up for a visit. "I want to talk to you," he said, and described how to get to the Columbia campus. Unlike BU, Columbia looked like a college campus in a movie, with red brick buildings around a green quadrangle dominated by low library and the huge seated figure of alma mater. I entered the journalism school beneath the bronze statue of Thomas Jefferson and met Dean Baker. He told me that I had been accepted in a special international fellows program that took 6 qualified students from each graduate school. I would have an additional 6 hours of classes a week in foreign relations, and my scholarship would be increased to $3,500, enough to get me through the year. I stammered my thanks. I was so excited by this unexpected bonanza that I could hardly find my way back to Midtown. I was already late for the Hearst Foundation luncheon, so I went directly to Toots Shores. When I was welcomed by Shore himself and a gaggle of television and media stars, I began to think I had stepped from the seats of the Greendale Theater into some Noel Coward film. In a fog of excitement, I ate and drank and chatted with the celebrities and hadn't the slightest idea what I was eating or saying. The only clear memory I have is of the aftermath of the luncheon, following the speeches congratulating the winners and the jokes by America's Toastmaster General, George Gisele, Randolph Hearst, the son of America's archetypical press lord and later known as Patty Hearst's father, stood up to make an unscheduled presentation. With a smile in my direction, he announced that the trustees of the Hearst Foundation had just voted to confer surprise fellowships on the 2 student prize winners in the sum of $500 to Miss Harrington and $1,000 to Mr. Gage. As we rose to accept our awards, I looked around the room at the trustees of the Hearst Foundation. I realized that they had probably taken pity on me after seeing the same threadbare suit draped on my undernourished 134-pound frame for 3 days. "Now you'll be able to go to graduate school," Randolph Hearst said as he shook my hand. "Yes, I will, sir," I mumbled. I never expected anything like this. Later that day, as my plane took off from LaGuardia and circled Manhattan before heading northeast towards Worcester, the sun was sinking behind New Jersey. Its rays hit the skyscrapers and the streets of Manhattan below, so that for a moment they really did seem to be made of gold, just as my mother had told us back in the village. Whether such immigrant fairy tales are true or not, one day in New York had brought me two separate fortunes. Now I not only had enough to pay for Columbia next fall, I had a $1,000 surplus. 2 days before, I had been a student who couldn't pay his rent. Now I was a capitalist who had to decide what to do with his extra money. But I knew the answer to that question the incident I received the second windfall. I would use the $1,000 to go back to Greece. The moment I heard Randolph Hearst announce my surprise fellowship, everything fell into place with a click, as if preordained. This summer after graduation, I was free because I didn't need to work. Then I would begin the year-long graduate program at Columbia and continue directly into my career. If I didn't take the opportunity now, there was no telling when I'd be able to do it. For a long time, I had known that someday I had to go back to my village to learn the details of what happened to my mother after we escaped. If I waited any longer, many witnesses might disappear or die. Even my grandparents might die if I postponed my journey. I realized it would be painful to learn my mother's fate. But I had left Greece as a boy of 9. Now I was 23 and a man, and it was time to start asking questions. After all, everything good that had happened to me, our escape from the village, our voyage to America, even the essay from Miss Hurd that started me on the path to journalism, all these had been caused by my mother. I was becoming more and more convinced that the events of my life did not happen by chance, and these two unexpected awards were the latest evidence. The Hearst Fellowship decided me that the time had come to return to our village. At the Worcester airport, my father was waiting. I could see his green Plymouth in the parking lot as soon as we were low enough for building, houses, and then vehicles to pop up from the flat map below. When we were on the ground, I spied him, wearing his best felt hat, waiting inside the small airport building. I walked across the tarmac, and when I got inside, he shook my hand gravely. "Now you've seen the White House and the President and New York City, and ridden in airplanes and sat at banquets with rich and famous men," he said. "Tell me all about it." I told him, saving the best for last. He drove out of the airport parking lot, the same place he had brought me to talk on the night after my day in court. He took the long, winding road down toward the city. First, I told him about the additional money from Columbia, and he smiled with pleasure. "That means you don't have to worry and work so hard this summer," he said. "You can rest a little." "I won't have to work at all," I said, and then I told him about the surprise fellowship from Hearst. $1,000, as much as a working man makes in months, and they give it to you for a surprise," he marveled. "They must be very rich men. What are you going to do with all this money?" I watched his profile as he drove. "I'm going to use it to go back to Greece for the summer," I said. He turned to look at me in alarm. "Why should you want to go back there?" he exclaimed. "There's nothing for you in Greece but painful memories. Your life is here now." "I must go, Patera," I said. "It's this feeling that's been growing in me for years. I have to go back there to find out things." "What things?" he was shouting now, and I could see fear as well as anger in his face. "Don't you remember that your mother told you never to return?" he demanded. "That her curse would be on you if you did." I don't think so, Dad, I said. This money falling into my lap just at the right time in my life when I can go. I think it was meant to be. Everyone makes his own life, Father replied grimly. Sometimes we make the wrong decisions, the way I did. That's what we talked about the last time we came up here. You're a man now, and that money is yours, so you have to decide what to do with it. I can't stop you, but I can advise you, and my advice is that you put Greece and everything that happened there behind you. Don't go back and open old wounds. You have a wonderful future waiting for you, but it's in this country. It's only for the summer, I protested, and I'll never have another chance like this one. If I don't go, I'll always regret it. I was trying to convince him of my resolution and win his approval. I have to go, Dad, I said. He didn't respond immediately, but when he reached the bottom of the hill and pulled up at the stop sign, he turned to look at me. Yes, he said. I can see that you do. We drove the rest of the way home in silence. I was relieved that he wasn't going to forbid me or continue to argue, but I couldn't dismiss his warnings as easily as I pretended. In fact, I wasn't at all sure I really wanted to know the answers that were waiting for me in Greece, but I felt my mother had brought me to this point, and I owed it to her to go back and ask the questions. Chapter 17. Return Voyage. Wherever I go, Greece wounds me. It was even harder to convince my sisters than my father of the wisdom of my returning to Greece. They were certain that I had come to America at such a young age and been so thoroughly assimilated that I was now a naive Americanaki, ready to be duped and victimized by the cunning Greeks. There are old ladies in the village who know all sorts of magic, warned my sister, telling me their names. They'll feed you a potion so that you'll fall in love with the first village girl you see and never return. Or, if they're communists, they may even poison you. When you go to one of their houses, you must be careful never to eat or drink anything. Even if you survive the magic of the village hags, admonished Olga, you'll probably step on a gorilla landmine and be blown to bits. They're buried all over the mountainside, you know. Just last summer, a shepherd boy was out tending his flock. Their advice and warnings engulfed me, but in the end, when they heard my father defend my decision, mainly because he believed that the men of the family must support each other against the women, they realized that my trip was inevitable. Father had his own barrage of advice. When your grandfather and my ingrate brother Photo asked why I didn't come with you, he instructed, you must tell them my father fears that if he ever looks on your accursed faces, he'll fly into a rage and kill you, so he has decided not to return. It's true, you know. I can never forgive either of them for abandoning my wife and children to the hands of the gorillas after all the years I sent money to those two scorpions. He also warned me several times to be careful how he behaved with women. In America, the girls are more free, he said. In Greece, if you compromise a young woman, if you are even alone with her for very long, her father will feel you have dishonored her and take harsh action. Like my sisters, he seemed convinced that some village Aphrodite would ensnare me and I would be lost forever. The final order he gave me was that I must go every day to the village coffee house and treat all the patrons in his name. I was always the big sport when I was back to the village. Wasted maybe $1,000 every trip buying food and drink, he recalled with nostalgia, saying the phrase big sport in English. They looked at me like a king and crowded around to hear my stories of America. I don't want them to think my son is less of a sport than his father, so you must show your generosity with a free hand. On the day before I left, he gave me $50 of his own money to add to my assets. And tell them these drinks are from Christos Katsianis, he reminded me. My entertainment fund grew swiftly because each of my sisters gave me $20 to help me make a good show, and Jimmy Zoris added another $50 with the instructions, have a good time. But these gifts were only the beginning. I was showered with money that was meant not for me, but for relatives of my relatives. In 1963, it was still fairly rare for an immigrant to return to Greece for a vacation. Only one or two of the Worcester Greeks would go down to the old country every summer. Therefore, the voyager must visit everyone else's relatives to carry them the good wishes of their kin in Exeunete, and to hand over a couple of dollars from the kinsman to show he still remembered the folks back home and was solvent. I had to buy a separate wallet to hold all the singles and fivers entrusted to me for this purpose. In the wallet, I kept a notebook with the names and addresses of the donors and recipients. These included far-flung cousins and second cousins, all my brother-in-law's relatives, and all my father's old cronies. When the small gifts were added up, my wallet of other people's money was stuffed with $714. People also wanted me to take material gifts back to Greece, but I refused. The two suitcases I had borrowed from Kanta were already full with my own family's gifts, lengths of dress fabric for my grandmother and my Aunt Nitsa, a suit and shirts for my grandfather, more shirts and cartons of cigarettes for my uncle, Barbafoto, my father's older brother, and for Uncle Andreas, the husband of my Aunt Nitsa. I had bought myself a khaki summer suit to replace the old shiny blue one, as well as a whole new wardrobe of shoes, underwear, shirts, and casual pants. I paid $410 for a round-trip charter flight advertised in the Hellenic Chronicle that was to leave on June 10th and return September 2nd, just in time for graduate school. My graduation from Boston University took place in June, but I was so distracted by my impending trip that the ceremony in the stadium at Nickerson Field was less exciting to me than to my four guests. My father, my two oldest nephews, whom I was trying to imbue with a taste for higher education, and Miss Hurd, my junior high school English teacher. After the ceremony, Miss Hurd took snapshots of me with my father and nephews, and then stood beside me while Father took some more. Earlier, he had told Miss Hurd the story of how my mother had been forced to leave school in third grade because village girls weren't allowed to associate with boys. But she had bribed a male cousin to repeat his lessons to her every day while she scratched letters in charcoal on a rock and thus had learned to read. Now Father took a picture of me standing next to my former teacher. As he handed the camera back to her, he said to me in Greek, "Think what it would have meant to your mother to be here today." He took off his glasses and polished them busily to hide his emotion. To me, however, graduation was just an anticlimax, something I had to do before my odyssey back to the village. The entire clan came to see me off at Logan Airport on June 10th, including the youngest nephews and nieces, who took great interest in the airplanes. My sisters kissed me and cried, and delivered more warnings and advice. When my flight was finally called, I kissed them all goodbye. Then I turned to my father, who had spent the entire drive from Worcester proudly describing what a success I'd be in the village. As he took my face between his hands and pulled my head down to kiss me, I was astonished to see his eyes also filled with tears. "My child," he said gruffly. His words suddenly brought back the sound of my mother's voice on the day we parted, and I felt a rush of fear that I wouldn't see him again. But it was too late to stop now. I walked across the tarmac to the plane, afraid to look back at him standing there. Once inside the plane, I realized the passengers were nearly all Greeks. The prayers and cries of fear as we took off, the socializing and laughter in the aisles throughout the journey, and the applause, shouts of congratulation, and hands inscribing the signs of the cross when we landed, reminded me of the differences between Greeks and Americans. Although we flew all night, no one slept, and the exuberance increased as we crossed the Gulf of Corinth toward Attica. When the plane dipped toward the Athens airport, with its small white Byzantine church and grazing flocks of sheep near the runway, I was struck by the vivid, unexpected colors, especially the sea with its medley of blues, turquoise, and purples. The clay-red earth and roof tiles and the blazing white buildings dazzled me. After 14 years of the dull grays and greens of Massachusetts, I had forgotten the colors of my native land. When the plane landed and the passengers surged toward the door with typical Greek disregard for waiting one's turn, I saw that Athens Airport was hardly bigger than Worcester's. No one was there to meet me because I had kept my visit a secret. I didn't want to be forced to stay in anyone's home for the same reasons Kanta had insisted on a hotel room. I collected my suitcases, passed through customs with my American passport, and hailed a taxi to take me into the city, an old rattletrap with woven rush seats and a driver who cheerfully whistled along to the cantatas on his radio while the worry beads, icons, and other protective charms hanging from the visor, swaying in the sultry wind through the open windows, charmed an accompaniment. As we passed rows of jerry-built five-story apartment buildings facing the seaside and approached the center of the capital, where dignified neoclassical mansions crumbled into the dusty streets among the huge concrete apartment developments, I was astonished to see that Athens looked more like a Midwestern town than the modern metropolis it had seemed 14 years earlier. I was disappointed at how crowded and unlovely the city was, but when we came to the end of Syngro Street and I saw the Parthenon gleaming like white bones high above the city, I once again felt the awe that I remembered from my first sight of the Acropolis. My hotel was the Amalia, right across from the walled park of the Royal Gardens, created by Amalia, the first Greek queen, after the revolution, who used to wander among the trees, artificial ponds, peacocks, and rose bushes, weeping with homesickness for her native Germany. At the hotel, I unpacked, took a shower, and asked the concierge how to get to Zonar's restaurant, where two of my cousins worked as waiters. It was 3 blocks down the street, he told me, just past Constitution Square. Everything I saw and heard in the streets fueled my excitement. The cries of the pretzel vendors, sponge peddlers, lottery sellers, and bootblacks. The old women in black kerchiefs and the smart Athenian matrons in parish fashions. On my way, I paused only a moment to gawk at the towering guards in their white pleated skirts and pom-pommed shoes goose-stepping back and forth in front of the royal palace. Then I hurried on to the elegant restaurant and outdoor cafe where my cousin, Yanni Getsouyanis, worked. It was Yanni who had looked after us when we first came to Athens from the refugee camp in 1949. Yanni himself, handsome as a movie star, and his 19-year-old wife, Katie, the first woman we ever saw wearing lipstick, had been part of the wonders of the city. So cosmopolitan with their stylish clothes and polished manners. Zonar's restaurant was a meeting place for Athenians, where businessmen and intellectuals could argue over drinks and pitas, and ladies of fashion could refresh themselves with elaborate ice cream concoctions after buying diamonds and gold jewelry at Zolotis across the street. I approached one of the waiters in his white jacket and black bow tie and asked for Yanni. "What do you want him for?" he asked suspiciously, taking in my American clothes and village-accented Greek. I explained that I was a relative from America. This caused a ripple of excitement, and I was escorted into a back room where the waiter telephoned Yanni at home. My cousin insisted that I come to his house at once and told me how to take a bus from the center to his neighborhood of Kiasiranini. It was an area heavily populated by refugees from Asia Minor who had fled the massacres launched by the Turks in 1922, arriving with little more than clothes they wore. Now these streets were lined with grim stucco cubes of connected buildings, draped with swags of laundry and electric wires. Yanni met me at the bus stop, wearing American-style Bermuda shorts. He was as affable as ever, although a bit fatter. He led me to the two-room apartment where he lived with his wife and two children, across the hall from another two rooms that housed his wife's parents. Katie, who at 19 had seemed a dangerous femme fatale in her lipstick, was now very pregnant with her third child, but she scurried about bringing food from the tiny kitchenette while Yanni pointed out all the improvements he had made in 14 years. They had a toilet and a shower inside the house and no longer had to rely on the outhouse in the courtyard, he said proudly. They had even managed to acquire a telephone, and someday, he chimed, he was going to build a second floor on top of the present rooms to double the amount of living space. I kept remembering how awestruck my sisters and I had been by Yanni's luxurious metropolitan residence on our first visit to Athens, when such novelties as telephones, toilets, and store mannequins had mystified and fascinated us. Now, despite the new conveniences, I couldn't help comparing the crowded two rooms to the way we lived in Worcester. Such luxuries as our car, television set, and big refrigerator made us seem like millionaires by Athenian standards. The next day, I visited the home of another relative, Fodi Hades, who was working as a trainee waiter at Zonar's. He lived with his wife and baby son in a crowded two-room home he had built on top of his father-in-law's small house in the section of Athens called Verona, for Lord Byron. Fodi and I had been friends since childhood. He was about 7 years older than I and had grown up in the other half of my grandparents' house in the village. His parents both died of tuberculosis when he was small, so his grandmother, Anastasia Hytis, raised him until the day in 1944 when she was murdered by the invading Germans, who set fire to our village and threw her into the flames of her burning house. Finding himself all alone at 12, Fodi lived with a relative until the end of the occupation, then walked all the way across Greece to Lamia, where he had an aunt. He worked first as a tinker's apprentice and then on road gangs until he decided to walk down to Athens, a distance of 140 miles, to see if he could find work there. Athens was jammed with new arrivals like Fodi, all fleeing their war-devastated villages, hoping to find jobs in the city. The boy nearly starved, sleeping wherever he could find a day's pay. Eventually, he met the 16-year-old daughter of a baker and married her, and Yanni got him a job as a busboy at Zonar's. every day as I ate in the restaurant and Fodi hovered nearby, snatching moments to chat. I was reminded that my fate would have been exactly like his after the war if I hadn't had a father living in America. In the ensuing days, I visited the relatives even more hard-pressed than Fodi. Some lived in shanty towns where they had bought tiny plots of land and erected illegal shacks of cinder blocks and corrugated tin, which were periodically knocked down by raiding police. My cousins simply rebuilt their shacks, hoping that one day the police might leave them standing. They were optimistic when I visited them because on the day I arrived in Greece, June 11, 1963, the Prime Minister, Konstantin Karamanlis, had resigned in a heated dispute with Queen Frederica. Whenever new elections loomed, both parties tried to curry votes by promising to make all existing shanty towns legal if the inhabitants would vote for their candidates. Despite the primitive conditions, every hovel I visited was immaculately clean. Tin cans planted with sweet basil and geraniums, embroidered doilies, and paper icons covered every surface. And when my relatives entertained me, they served me meals so large that I knew the feast meant weeks of starvation after my visit. It was a point of honor to feed a guest far more than he could eat. Finally, I began dropping in unannounced, so the mistress of the house couldn't spend the whole day cooking, but she still would run to the nearest butcher or wring the neck of the family hen and cook it for me. I always came with boxes of Zonar's confections for the host, 50 drachma notes for the children, and an American dollar or 100 drachma note for the old people who were tucked into dark corners grieving for their lost villages, while their children worked in basements, factories, or restaurants and lived in slums. I want to go home. I wish my bones were in the church of Panya, beside my father's, instead of rotting here in this cave, an old man mourned as I slipped a dollar bill into his yellowed hand. Your father lives like a king in America, and I'm left in a corner by my children, like a piece of refuse. 2 days after my arrival, I wrote a long letter to my father describing how much worse the conditions were than I had expected. I went to the post office on Voulis Street near Constitution Square to mail it, along with some postcards, and when I got back to my hotel, I discovered that the wallet was missing from my pocket, the one with over $700 of other people's money in it. The post office had already closed when I got back. I lay awake all night wondering how I could reimburse all those relatives. I'd have to give up graduate school and go to work. But when the post office's doors opened in the morning, I was shown into the manager's office, I learned that the wallet had been found and turned in by the janitor without a cent missing. All the post officer manager wanted was a signed statement from me, attesting to the honesty of the postal employees. I gave it gladly and demanded to meet the janitor, knowing that the wallet had held as much money as he would make in 2 years. He was brought in wearing much mended work clothes, and he refused my offer of a reward with dignity, saying, "I did nothing but what was right." In the end, I managed to slip a 1,000 drachma note into his pocket and left the post office with a light heart and an improved perspective on Athens. The living conditions might be poor and the economy stricken, but the Greeks had many qualities Americans lacked, I realized. Like the janitor, they were scrupulously honest in their personal dealings. No matter how poor, they had an appreciation for life and a talent for enjoying themselves that a millionaire might envy. The relatives I visited went out every night, if only for coffee at the neighborhood cafe. They teased each other, flirted, and argued with a playfulness that I quickly learned to imitate. Their hospitality could move me to tears. Greek men and women alike communicated better than Americans with honest affection. I became used to seeing men kissing and hugging each other and greeting, and teenage children kissing their parents goodbye. I learned to catch and toss back the conversational jokes and barbs that filled every Greek conversation. I grew accustomed to staying up every night until long after midnight, savoring the banter, the political arguments, and gossip. But after 2 weeks, I reminded myself that I hadn't come to Greece to spend pleasant summer evenings at Athenian cafes. It was time to go back to my village. I flew from Athens to Corfu, taking a hotel room in the old Venetian-style city where my parents had stayed when my father saved my mother from a wasting disease by bringing her out of the mountains to the European-trained doctors. Her convalescence in Corfu had been the happiest time of her life, in the air scented with the perfumes of the orange groves, and the sea still seemed to carry the memory of my parents riding in an old-fashioned landau to see the fabled beaches of Prospero's Isle. I telegraphed my grandfather to meet me on the mainland the next day and spent the morning visiting more cousins before boarding the ferry boat. Within 2 hours, we were approaching the town of Igoumenitsa, built up like an amphitheater around the harbor. This was where my sisters and I had stayed for 9 months after our escape, living in the corrugated tin huts of the refugee camp until our grandfather escorted us to Athens for our voyage to America. This was also where I had learned my mother's fate. When grandfather returned from his journey to the village and described finding her body in a shallow mass grave. While the boat was still at a distance from the harbor, I could make out the long road lined with plane trees where I had been walking when I got my first sight of the sea. Higher up the hill, the tin Quonset huts of the refugee camp still stood, now inhabited by soldiers. As the ferry boat neared the dock, I could finally make out the white-haired figure of my grandfather, looking just as he had on that final day in Piraeus, when the marine carp steamed away and he was the last person I saw, recognizable only by the way he waved his walking stick in farewell. Now it was as if he had been waiting for me for 14 years, frozen in time. As we docked, I saw that my grandfather had brought my father's brother Photo with him. My grandfather was 83 and had worked as a millwright all his life. He was lean and tanned with white hair and mustache and the muscular arms of an athlete. My uncle Photo was 81, a thinner, nearly toothless version of my father, completely bald with a round face and glasses. But he moved with the strong stride of a mountain dweller, accustomed to walking long distances in high altitudes. My grandfather scrutinized me for a moment, then announced, "You left a child, and now look at you." I had always feared my grandfather with his terrifying temper, cold silences, and unsettling glare. Both his wife and his two daughters, my mother and my Aunt Nitsa, had often felt his blows, although he had never hit me. The roar of his voice was enough to frighten me into obedience. In the village, Kitsohitis was known as a tightwad, a vengeful enemy and a compulsive philanderer, but he was even better known for his shrewdness, his miraculous skill at building and repairing mills, and his quick mind, which made him one of the most respected men in the Morgana Mountains. Until I sailed to America, my grandfather was the only male relative who influenced me. Now I saw that we looked very much alike, with the same lean, angular features, deep-set eyes under heavy brows, and abundant hair. My father and Photo and my sisters Olga and Glykeria all had the softer, rounder features and physiques of the Goitsianis clan. But I had the heightest features of my mother and her father. I wondered how much of my grandfather's nature was in me and how much of me resembled my father, who was in every way his opposite. As grandfather stared at me, perhaps wondering the same thing, Uncle Photo asked, "Did you recognize us?" "Of course he did, idiot," snapped my grandfather. "He wasn't a baby when he left." 9 years old as a baby, Photo replied, smiling. "But in America, he has become a man. The only trouble is, he looks just like you." "You'd rather he grew up bald and toothless like you," retorted my grandfather. "I may be bald and toothless, but I can still shoot out a quail's eye at 100 meters and climb up to Prophet Elias while you're still struggling past Suli Spring," teased Photo. It comforted me to hear them going at each other with the same competitive insults they had always used. We hired a taxi to take us to Philaetes, the town at the foot of the mountains where we would spend the night. During the bumpy half-hour ride, while the two old men bickered and quizzed me about everyone back in the States, I could feel my grandfather's eyes on me appraisingly. He hadn't yet passed judgment, but would reserve his opinion until I had been tested. It annoyed me that I cared so much about winning his approval. I had been free of his tyranny for so long, but now I found myself trying to sound clever and worldly so he would not think of me as a foolish Americanaki. Glyceria had arranged for us to stay the night in her father-in-law's home in Philaetes. Procopi's father, a civil servant, had a large Turkish-style house surrounded by a wall enclosing a pleasant garden and a separate kitchen, where the women of the household, Procopi's married sister as well as his mother, labored to cook us a feast in the beehive-shaped ovens. I set about purchasing the sweets, pastries, Turkish delight, and staples like salt, sugar, butter, meat, and bread that my sisters had told me to take to Leah. That night I slept in one of the cool stone-walled rooms of the Turkish house and dreamed that I was back in the village, a boy again, setting traps for birds with my uncle Andreas. My grandfather had always scorned Andreas, the soft-spoken, self-effacing husband of Aunt Nitsa, because he was only a poor cobbler with almost no customers and no money. My eccentric aunt dominated him, never letting him interrupt her harangues, but he had been the kindest man I knew in my childhood. It was Andreas who taught me to make and shoot a slingshot, to set traps for birds and animals, to play checkers on a tree stump. He was the one who consoled me after the news of my mother's death by sitting silently nearby. When I left for America, Andreas was the one I most regretted leaving, except perhaps for my frail grandmother, who had also been one of my protectors. In my dream, I heard Andreas' voice telling me how to set the traps for the birds. And when I woke, blinking in the morning sun, I realized that I really had heard Andreas' voice speaking. He had sneaked out of the village before dawn to send the mountain and welcome me. He also seemed unchanged by the years. He was still wearing his grimy shepherd's cap and had a hand-rolled cigarette tucked behind his ear, with one large curl combed from the sides and plastered over his forehead in a vain attempt to hide his baldness. He embraced me as shyly as ever and scarcely said a word beyond, "You've come back." We hired a taxi in Philaetes to drive us towards Leah, but when I had left the village, there had been no road beyond Agais Pontes, but now the dirt ribbon twined back and forth up the cliffs between boulders and scrub pines, around cypress and ruined chapels, all the way to Leah in Babori, hidden above the clouds. As the bone-jarring road climbed, every time a village came into view, I was sure it was Leah. The road had changed everything, and nothing looked familiar, although I once had known every stone of these mountains by heart. "That's it," I'd cry, and my grandfather would snort with laughter, implying, "No, that was Povla or Samantha. I should show a little patience, he said. We'd get there soon enough. As the taxi climbed higher and my ears popped in the thin altitude, I realized that the memory I had considered flawless was now badly corroded by time. If I couldn't recognize my own village, I wondered, how would I retrieve all the details of the years when my mother was alive? When we finally entered Leah, my grandparents' house was the first one we reached. The road had reorganized everything in the village. It passed just above the roof of the Heidi's house, bisecting the vertical footpath, originally the main thoroughfare, that wound up past the house's courtyard and the spring just outside the gate. My father, climbing that footpath towards the Church of St. Demetrios in 1924, had looked into the Heidi's garden and seen a 17-year-old girl with wheat-colored hair tilling the soil and had immediately decided to marry her. But now the taxi stopped on the road above the house, and I was looking down into the courtyard. My grandmother and aunt had hurried outside at the first sound of the taxi and were staring up at me. Because the mountainside was so steep, I had to pick my way down to the door of the house, stepping from rock to rock. My grandfather, Barbafoto, and Andreas carried down my luggage and the many parcels of food from Filiates. Take that stuff inside before the neighbors see it, snapped Anitza, without any word of welcome. Then she turned to look me over. Took you long enough to come back to us, didn't it? She grumped. Let's go inside and see what you brought. I expected my grandmother to burst into tears at the sight of me, for I had always been her favorite, but the tiny, shriveled old woman only stood with her hands clasped beneath her apron and stared at me in bewilderment. My grandfather had warned me on the way that her mind was beginning to fail. Is that him? It doesn't look like him, my grandmother asked no one in particular. It's him, it's him, Nitza muttered. Now come inside. The Heidi's house, where we had lived with my grandparents after the guerrillas threw us out of our own home up in the Paravoli, was just as I remembered it. Two rooms on either side of a tiny hall, each with its own fireplace. The outhouse was in one corner of the walled courtyard. The goats were in the basement, and the only source of water was the mountain spring outside the gate. I could see that my relatives had hastily whitewashed the walls, no doubt to clean them for my arrival. But the job had been sloppily done, with white paint splashed on the windows and the green ceiling. My grandfather proudly pointed out two cots he had acquired for the upper chamber, the good room reserved for guests. He and my grandmother, whom everyone called Migali, the old one, still slept on pallets beside the fireplace in the other room. But now I would have a bed and even a set of springs that he had brought in Filiates and covered with a straw mattress. At his insistence, I sat down on the mattress, for there was no other furniture except for the low table or the sufra at which they ate, crouching on their haunches, and the casella against one wall, piled high with blankets of my grandmother's dowry. The others sat on the floor and studied me, except for Andreas, who stood in a corner as if not daring to take up too much space. Nitza immediately collected all the sweets, pastries, and foodstuffs I had brought and said she would store them in the pantry, a small nook at the back of the house. And I'll just pack up a few things to take home with me, she said. I'm sure you will, but will you leave anything for us, growled my grandfather. She's 59 and her husband 64. And they're still eating my food, he complained to me, lighting a cigarette and not offering one to Andreas. Why don't Andreas and Nitza live here with you, I asked, thinking of the wretched hut they had at the opposite end of the village. Then they could help you and Migali. Help us? Eat us out of house and home, you mean, he shouted. They're here far too much anyway. It was the same old hostility I remembered. Nitza complaining while my grandfather sniped at her. His oldest daughter, with her laziness and poverty, was a continual disappointment to him. I passed out the gifts, the clothing and lengths of dress fabric, and the dollars that my sister had sent for all of them. My sisters had given me additional money to hand to Andreas and Megali in secret, for they knew that both grandfather and Nitza would immediately confiscate anything their spouses had. When I handed some dollar bills to my grandmother, I leaned over and kissed her on the forehead, and she looked helplessly at her husband. "Are you sure that's him?" she quavered. "I don't remember him." Later, as I sat on the bed answering questions about my family, I was startled when my grandmother rose to her feet, silently walked over, and kissed my brow. "Edie Eleni, just like Eleni," she said. The words and the sudden recognition in her eyes brought tears to mine. Aunt Nitza took the money I handed her, blessing me profusely and my sisters as well. "If it weren't for you, I'd be dead long ago," she said, glaring at my grandfather. "I remember in the summer of 1955, Andreas and I hadn't eaten for 2 days, and I wasn't speaking to your grandfather as usual, the skinflint. I decided to go to the ravine and throw myself off. But as I passed the Kefanian, they told me there was a letter from the United States. Glycaria had sent $2, and you put in $5. So I went and I bought meat and made soup, and it saved our lives. Yes, you barely have enough to survive. That's why you're just skin and bones," retorted my grandfather, indicating Nitza's rotund body. She pretended she hadn't heard him. "What can I get you?" she asked. "The galley's too far gone to cook any more. Would you like some coffee or some reiki?" "No, just cold water," I said with sudden longing. But I want it from Matsala, and I want to get it myself." You have been listening to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Naomi. Thank you for listening.
Hi, the Bay State Council of the Blind has available free Braille copies of a new publication from the CDC. It's entitled COVID-19 Vaccination Guidance, and this one-volume publication focuses on information about the vaccines and vaccine safety. To get your free copy, send your name and mailing address to kim.charlson@perkins.org. That's kim.charlson@perkins.org.
Would you like to hear news from Auburn, Grafton, Millbury, and Sutton that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Monday at 5 p.m. Would you like to hear news from Blackstone Valley and Webster that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Thursday at 5 p.m.